Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where we have a sound effect, and then we don't. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I really hope you surprise them one week and throw in, like, a duck quacking or something.
Every once in a while, I do a different sound effect. I don't know if you're not listening or not, but every once in a while, I mix it up.
I scan through, but yeah.
Okay. We're busy making them. We don't have time to listen to them all the time. I mean, I do. I'm editing them, but Whitney, not so much.
So, if we sound dumb, then it's just out there. We just charge on ahead, and the dumbness shall remain.
Anyway, my name is Lynn Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. He's Whitney.
Yeah, we said that part.
We did already.
What are we reviewing this week? We've
done that so many millions of times. You ever, like, drive to work and then forget how you drove to work because you've taken that route so many times?
Yeah. It's like, what streets did you take? Oh, gosh. I don't remember. I was just sort of doing it.
Yeah, you've done it. I've done it a million times. Nothing remarkable happened this time. It's just one of a million forgettable, boring, humdrum memories. Not that podcasting is humdrum, but it's just we say our names over and over.
It's especially bad if you forget, like, if you took a bath this morning yet, or if you had breakfast. Like, am I hungry? No. Wait, did I eat already? I don't remember.
Well, I'll do that.
Oh, you don't?
No, okay. But sometimes I'll be, like, groggy, and, like, my partner will nudge me, and they'll be like, hey, your mom's calling, or something like that. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And I wake up, and later I'm like, I haven't talked to mom in a few days. We should call her. And they're like, you were just dead, weren't you? I'm like, yeah, I don't sleep good. speaking of which, it is almost midnight, and it is time to review some movies over at Critically Acclaimed. This week on Critically Acclaimed, you're reviewing the new releases Jungle Cruise, The Green Knight. Is it Green Knight or The Green Knight?
It's The Green Knight.
The Green Knight. Stillwater. Help me out with this one. Is it A.E. Mofe?
A.E. Mofe. It's a Nigerian film.
And the new Netflix rom-com, Resort to Love.
And Stillwater. Did you say Stillwater?
I said Stillwater.
Okay. All right.
And Resort to Love.
Yeah, I was trying to distract from that.
I had to see this movie for no other reason than because it's not, like, proud of being about love. It's ashamed of having to resort to it. That's like having a romantic comedy called If We Must.
Sure. There is one called Just Go With It.
Yeah.
Like, whatever it is. Just whatever.
There's
it's going to be
one
dumb.
Get Over It with
Ben
Foster. Like, this one's just like, If we have to resort to love to get you to watch this movie.
I found
so
if a film...
So be it would be
so
a good
be
one
it,
as well.
Yeah. It'll just turn out whatever, the movie. I've discovered
could
that if you see if there's a film title with a pun in it, it's you're like a fly to sugar. You'll just fly right to that thing.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I?
You didn't see The Green Knight this week, which is the one all the critics are raving about.
Was that a pun?
No pun
then
in The
Green
Knight.
Then why would I go see that? Why would I go see that
But you did manage
crap?
To see Resort to Love.
Resort to Love was right there. Resort to Love was on Netflix. Resort to Love made it easy for me.
I'll go out of my way, of course, to see, you know, five-hour Filipino epics from,
Let me ask you this question.
Take place in, what's, like, really dour circumstances.
What's harder for you? To watch a five-hour Lav Diaz epic or to watch the, like, 90-minute Resorts to Love? Be honest. What's harder for you?
Watching, in terms of, like, access, like, if it's just on Netflix?
I'm not talking about access. I'm talking about for you. Like, what is easier for you to do?
I would rather rewatch, like, a 5 3/4 hour Lav Diaz film than some of those horrendous Hallmark Christmas movies you've had me sit through.
Then who's the real trooper here? Maybe it's me. That's all I'm saying. You're out there watching, like, this, all this, like, ultra classy.
Well, I don't know about ultra
brilliant,
classy, but
life changing world cinema. I'm in the trenches. Okay? Someone has to do this, and it's going to be me. Anyway, we're reviewing a bunch of new movies this week, and those are them.
What would you like to start with, William?
Well, we usually like to start with the big one, and the big one is Jungle Cruise. This is the new movie from Disney based on yet another theme park attraction, the Jungle Cruise ride, which was one of the first rides to open at the park. It was their opening day.
Yeah. And
1955.
This is the 12th film to be based on a Disney park attraction,
mm-hmm.
and not a movie that's been turned into an attraction.
Are you including all of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies?
Yes,
that list?
All five of the Pirates movies.
Okay, then we got Country Bears, yeah. Tower of Terror.
Yeah,
that's
seven.
Others as well.
Mission to Mars.
Haunted
Mansion.
Yeah.
Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
And two others as well.
Very exciting ones, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, Jungle Cruise and one that I'm now forgetting, but there is a 12th one.
They turned Tron into like kind of a ride at Disneyland, but then they did Tron Legacy. Yeah. So I think you. That's
great. Well, Tron was a movie first, and then they put it as part of the People Mover. Whatever. So I think it was a film first.
I'm just trying to be pissy and at it and ruin the number.
Isn't
it technically 13? It's fine, whatever. Anyway, Disney makes a lot of amusement park attractions, and a lot of amusement park attractions have stories. They do. And so turning them into a movie isn't the weirdest thing in the world, necessarily.
And Jungle Cruise is a weird case because Jungle Cruise was meant to be a Jungle Cruise.
Mm.
You got on a boat, you rode around on a track underwater, and there were animatronics sort of in an outdoor setting.
Mm-hmm. And real animals as well. In fact, they had like a real kind of old plants and animals in the area as well in order to, sort of heighten that experience. But they weren't real hippos,
animatronic hippos. And at some point they rewrote the script to Jungle Cruise to being sort of cynical about itself. And I don't know when that flipped. Probably sometime in the 1980s.
I only went to the Jungle Cruise once or twice when I was a kid, and I don't have a lot of vivid memories other than a few of the animatronics stood out, and the script that... Jungle Cruise is one of those rides where there's actually like a human being in front of you the whole time giving you the presentation.
Yeah.
And they have a script. And, there's a little leeway and different people do it slightly differently, but there's a lot of puns. There's a lot of jokes.
That's when, I think that was like when they updated the script, was they started to be like, oh, here's a Bengal tiger. I can weigh up to 650 pounds and leap 30 feet. There's a snake. It can weigh up to 650 pounds and leap 30 feet. And there's a guy and he can weigh up to 650 pounds and he can jump 30 feet. You know? And then you go behind a waterfall and you're supposed to be splashed. And look, it's the backside of water. It's a butt joke, which they make in the movie
I still barely get that joke. It's like
backside is
I know that people backside means butt, but of water? Who gives a shit?
Yeah.
I've never understood that joke. Maybe it's been delivered badly. I just never understood.
There are some jokes in the script about how the person giving the Jungle Cruise ride is only doing this at Disneyland now because they were a failed actor. And that joke spun off into a wonderful Weird Al Yankovic song.
That's a good one.
Called Skipper Dan, about how this guy who is doing the Jungle Cruise ride because he never got a good acting gig.
The original Jungle Cruise ride was unironic. The idea of the Jungle Cruise ride was a big part of what Disneyland was when it opened, which was less about selling intellectual properties. There was that too. Mickey Mouse was walking around. But it was more about trying to give people a wide variety of experiences in just one location.
Like a globe, the whole world.
Yeah.
And indeed, it was separated out into like miniature countries, Disneyland. Mm. There's Adventureland and Frontierland and Tomorrowland.
Mm. And so the Jungle Cruise was actually this like weird... hybrid of a whole bunch of different rivers throughout the world. So you'd see animals that would never be together in the same ecosystem. Yeah. And so this was directly inspired by stuff that was popular at the time. The movie The African Queen, which is about another Jungle Cruise, where Katharine Hepburn plays a missionary who falls in love with a hard-drinking sailor played by Humphrey Bogart, and together they fight Germans in World War I.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, that will happen in the Jungle Cruise movie. Not the Katharine Hepburn, Humphrey Bogart part, but otherwise kind of. That was a big hit. That was a huge, hugely successful, popular movie. Won an Academy Award for Humphrey Bogart. Came out 2 years before Jungle Cruise. You better believe they were playing off the success of that. Mm-hmm. And that, in turn, was playing off the success of decades upon decades of successful adventure, sort of safari-type motion pictures that showed audiences stuff from around the world. And there was always this shitty sort of undercurrent of imperialism.
European colonialism was a big part of
overcurrent, anyway. Sometimes it was really in your face about it, and sometimes it was merely the fundamental implication, but...
And we can bring up Trader Horn here, if you like.
Oh, God. One of the worst movies ever nominated for Best Picture. We covered it on our podcast. Only the best. Yeah, we review every Best Picture nominee ever.
It's racist. It features, like, real animal death on camera.
Oh, yeah. It's horrifying.
It's, and I think... And all of those things that are actually part of these adventure stories.
Allegedly a real person death, too. Like, someone who actually got mauled or run over by, like, a rhino or something. So it's just... offensive and cruel and racist and sexist, and it made so much money.
Yeah, and indeed, Jungle Cruise is tapping into a lot of that colonialist stuff.
They want to have
1955 was a very white time. Yeah. The rumors that Disneyland did not accept black people into the park are not true. Mm-hmm. That was a rumor that was spreading around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of racist elements to the Jungle Cruise ride that have since been removed.
Yeah.
But I feel like this new film, which is directed by Jaume Coyet-Serra.
I always refer to Jaume Coyet-Serra, but I actually don't.
Okay.
Who is mostly a director of horror movies and thrillers. He did the House of Wax remake. He did that couple of Liam Neeson movies.
And I feel like this, along with a lot of the other Disney remakes, is an attempt to sort of re-up the brand, but remove the racist or problematic elements.
Mm-hmm. We want to be as pulpy as we possibly can. We want to evoke the adventure stories of the 30s and 40s and 50s, even though this takes place in World War I. That's the vibe that we're going for cinematically. But we want none of the shitty subtext if we can avoid it.
Yeah.
And... mostly they succeed. There's always going to be some shitty stuff.
There's still an Italian stereotype, but at least he's played by a guy named Giamatti. So you look at like the remake of Dumbo. That's actually one of the remakes I kind of like, just because there's some weird subversive things in it.
They didn't just do Dumbo again. Yeah. They did something interesting. They did something new in it. For that.
But you know, Dumbo has a racist portion in it with some racist crow characters that are based on racist caricatures. So let's redo Dumbo. We can still have Dumbo. Mm. The name Dumbo can still be healthily associated with Disney, but now it's not racist anymore. And I feel like that's what they're doing with a lot of these new things. We can still have the Jungle Cruise ride, but now it's not racist anymore.
Exactly.
Now we have a film that is very, very, very heavily borrowing from Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, in terms of tone and setting and mood.
It's basically, the Jungle Cruise movie stars Emily Blunt, always awesome, love Emily Blunt. She plays a British explorer in the 1910s, I guess it's 1910s.
Around World War I, like 1918,
around there. She believes that she has found a clue to a magical tree that is essentially the Fountain of Youth. It will cure any disease, extend your lifespan. It could change medicine as we know it, and who knows, maybe stem the tide of the war. So her and her brother, played by Jack Whitehall, it's Jack Whitehall, right?
Yes.
Okay. They travel, they steal this stuff, and turns out Jesse Plemons plays the youngest son of Kaiser Wilhelm, and he's like after them.
Fictional son of Kaiser Wilhelm.
Yeah. So they abscond, they steal stuff from an adventuring society, and they abscond to the Amazon, where Dwayne Johnson has been making a living.
Excuse me, he was based on a real character.
Who, Jack Whitehall?
Prince Joaquin.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
They've gone to the Amazon and they need a guide, and it's sure enough, Dwayne Johnson is a riverboat captain who has been giving a fake, bullshitty tourist trip, entirely unlike the Jungle Cruise ride, and is basically in dire financial straits and owes a lot of money to Paul Giamatti, so he'll do anything, and so he agrees to take them to this magical tree.
And even though he's been giving these BS tours, he's actually an experienced riverboat captain.
It's actually a lot like Alan Quatermain, who King Solomon's Mines. Mm. Like, he's an experienced, he knows everything he needs to know about how to survive in the wilds, but he's making a living just taking shitty rich people to shoot elephants. Mm. And, it's kind of a shitty story in a lot of ways, but in any case, but the point is he's not trying very hard right now. And so he's going to end up on a adventure with Emily Blunt, and wouldn't you know it, they're going to bicker.
They're going to bicker in a lighthearted way, and they're going to reveal a lot of romantic chemistry. Mm. And Emily Blunt is, she can have chemistry with a tree stump. Like she is one of those kinds of actresses.
Yeah, and she's just great.
And Dwayne Johnson is like, even when his movies suck, you like him anyway. Yeah, he was in a movie very similar.
What
to
a great called, movie star quality that
yeah,
is.
Yeah. He was in a movie a lot like this called Journey to the Mysterious Island, with Journey to the number two.
Utterly forgettable, except Dwayne Johnson's good in it.
He's great. He bounces a berry off of his chest toward the audience, and it's in 3D, so that's a memorable moment. It's difficult to describe Jungle Cruise, however, without evoking all of the movies that it's clearly knocking off.
So you got certainly people who made this are fans of the 1999 version of The Mummy, right down
which in turn was inspired by Raiders of the Lost Ark anyway.
Well, of course, but I think we're at the point now where The Mummy had enough staying power that they're specifically evoking The Mummy, right down to one of the opening like comedy bits is Emily Blunt in like a giant library on one of those like rolling step ladders, which is a gag right out of The Mummy. They do it a little differently, but they're doing it.
Yeah.
And the whole
the young British lady adventurer, her ne'er-do-well kind of foppish brother, coming along with an experienced adventurer on a big in a non-European locale, trying to find some faraway adventure, and they run afoul of monsters.
And it turns out much like The Mummy, but a lot more like the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. There are monsters afoot here. Obviously, Kaiser Wilhelm's youngest son is after them with his big submarine in the Amazon. Must have been hell trying to get it there.
It's like in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen where they have Captain Nemo's ship.
Oh yeah, he's got submarines in Venice.
Going through the canals in Venice.
The canals are not that deep.
The Nautilus, there you go. The Nautilus is, couldn't fit in a canal in Venice, but it like rises up and it's like a story high.
I know, it's a fun idea, but it's one of those things where people know how deep a canal is. Like, it's not really going to work. Anyway, Jesse Plemons, in order to capture them, decides to awaken the cursed conquistadors, led by Aguirre, played by Edgar Ramirez. Aguirre, who had previously evoked the wrath of God, and now they are cursed to be immortal and have superpowers that enable them to kill more people. Why did they get this curse? Because they killed people.
Yeah,
and I'm like, wait a minute, why would you curse somebody
to
make them more powerful and more deadly? And the only real downside of the curse, other than living forever, which can be a bummer after a while, is you can't leave the river area. Yeah. And I'm that's where you want them to leave. They killed everyone here. Why would you make them more powerful and force them to stay and make them mad at you?
I think the curse didn't think things out clearly.
I don't think it
because,
did.
Because it turns Aguirre and his conquistador buddies into, monsters that are made up of things in the jungle. So like Aguirre himself is made of snakes. One guy's made of bees. I like the bee guy.
The bee guy stands out.
Yeah, because the bee guy's delicious. Because he's eating his own honey. He's like, I'm made of honey. One guy's sort of a tree man.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was supposed to be their curse. It's like, you're just part of the jungle now. And it's like, but now if I can't die and I have snake powers. No, you don't have snake powers. You're snakes. Yeah, but I can kill people with... Oh, shit, we didn't think of that.
Didn't think this through at all.
Maybe the curse wasn't well thought out. Everything continues incredibly predictably.
Yeah.
They find an underground thing. They have to put a key in a thing and turn it, and a cage opens up, and something floods, and they find treasures, and
someone gets kidnapped, now we gotta do a thing. You know where this is going. The Jungle Cruise is not trying to reinvent anything. There's almost... nothing novel about this movie.
There's a bloody-minded insistence on not reinventing anything.
There's only two things that I think are even remotely noteworthy about this movie. And I will say this. It's not a hard watch. Okay? The cast is fun.
It goes down super smooth. It just has no flavor.
It's just completely hollow. And there's only two things about it that I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. Or at least interesting. One is that Jack Whitehall's character actually does have a coming out scene, which is played straight.
Yeah, played straight.
Weird way to put it. Sorry, I didn't mean that.
Strange wording, but
all right. But it's not played. It's not played for laughs. It's not like some weird wild moment. It's actually just very sincere. He's explaining to Dwayne Johnson, what his life has been like. Mm. And he says, you know, I'm the oldest son of a wealthy family and they wanted me to marry. And I said, I can't, I don't love women. Mm. And that's that. And my sister is the only one who stayed by me. And that's why I'm going to be with her no matter what she does, even though I'm completely ill-suited for this adventure. And I'm watching this scene and I'm like, you know what? Kudos. That's reasonably well handled. 5 minutes later, there's a scene where something bad's happened to Dwayne Johnson. And every time Jack Whitehall suggests he helps, they turn it into a gay innuendo joke.
Yeah.
Boy, does that undermine all of the goodwill.
A little bit of gay panic thrown in to balance out the anything progressive that Disney might possibly do.
Fuck, Disney. Why even do that? You didn't need any of that.
They're so afraid of putting gay characters like in the fore. Mm-hmm. I mean, why wasn't The Rock gay? Just make him gay.
Please.
Just do it.
I'll say this. I don't think he and Emily Blunt are funny together. Mm. I never picked up romance from them. I picked up good friends.
Yeah.
That's the vibe I got. I never got that they were going to end up making out. I couldn't
be with you. My husband died and I've been heartbroken ever since.
Yeah, I buy. Anyway. But the other thing that stood out for me, and for the life of me, I cannot figure out why this is in the film. Hmm. Why is the score partially and directly derived from Metallica's Nothing Else Matters? That's the first thing in the movie. You hear the violins. And I'm like, wait a minute. Why is Metallica in this? Well, and it turns out, and I've read the lyrics to the song, and I'm trying to think out, like, because...
I could sing it for you. I love that song.
It's a classic song. Like, that's top flight Metallica right there. But, like, it has nothing to do with the movie. It has nothing thematically to do with the movie. In fact, the first time we hear it, we're hearing backstory, which incredibly matters. It's really important, actually, to the whole movie. It's cool sounding because it's an amazing song, but what's the point of that? What were you getting at? I'm so confused by it.
I heard an interview with James Hetfield of Metallica, and he was singing Nothing Else Matters at a concert, and you noticed like couples slow dancing to it. And he said, I'm sorry, I thought we were at a fucking Metallica show. Like, there's no slowness. Like, you wanted to stop and say, no slow dancing.
Well, also, again,
this is actually kind of a dour, depressing song, like all Metallica songs.
Yeah, but that would be like slow dancing to Unforgiven.
Yeah.
Or Unforgiven 2. Or Unforgiven 3.
Oh. Unforgiven 3 is pretty good.
It's okay. Unforgiven's, we're all downhill from the first one, if you ask me.
Death Magnetic's a pretty good record.
I'm not saying it's a bad record. I'm just saying it's not as good as
James Hetfield should have been in this movie.
That'd be cool. Why not?
There's also a really strange conceit that we mentioned the conquistador who's made of bees.
Oh yeah, he can send bees.
Like evidently those bees are agents of his. Yeah. And there's some really baffling scenes because they're not really fully explained.
Yeah.
Of Jesse Plemons communicating with a bee.
Yeah.
Like, he's talking to it, and the bee's crawling around on a map, showing him where to go.
Yeah, go here. Hmm. And then there's, a later bit where Jesse Plemons, has to kill the bees so the bees won't know he's planning to, betray the conquistadors. And I'm like, okay, for a moment, you're interesting here.
Yeah.
Because this is admittedly a scene I have not seen before. Jesse Plemons arguing with bees. Yeah. I just like saying bees. It's my favorite card in Cards Against Humanity. It's just dot, dot, dot. Bees?
You gotta want to be a beekeeper. I want to keep bees.
I want to keep them so they won't get away.
Like my coffee, like I like my women. Covered in bees.
Classic Eddie.
Classic Eddie Izzard bit. Yeah, it is a totally amenable, very friendly, totally inoffensive adventure film. Good for the family. I just wish it had done something
anything
interesting, something new, a single concept that I could have gotten along with. It is nothing but the things it's derived from, and it is derived from fun things, and it is itself fun, but I'm not interested. It's not grabbing me in any sort of new way.
There's an old saying I've heard many, many a time, which is that audiences don't want something new. They want something in a slightly new way.
Yeah, they want to be surprised in the same way every time. The way I've heard
it. This is something old, but okay. They want to be surprised in a new way, in the same way. This is being not surprised in the same way. You completely messed up my whole metaphor here.
Terribly sorry.
My point is that we want the same old thing, but just slightly different, just slightly tweaked. Mm. The only thing different about this really is that it's in the Amazon instead of a pirate ship or instead of the Egyptian desert. Like, it's really bringing nothing new to the table. And this is going to be someone's first adventure film. And for that person, for that kid, or just someone who wasn't really interested in the genre, and they're going to see this and they're going to find it perfectly charming and they're going to think we're being too harsh on it. For you, it's probably a C+. Mm. Because this is evoking the kind of spirit of adventure, avoiding as much offensiveness as possible. They don't really deal with a lot of the subtext here. I mean, we've got like these like conquistadors who defiled the land and now they've been cursed forever and they
to be part of the land.
Yeah, and they don't really take that to any meaningful conclusion. Yeah, it's just sort of a vague idea in the background. You can cut the magic conquistadors out and you'd have the same movie.
There's a lot of there's this.
You can just have had Jesse Plemons.
Yeah, I was about to say they're also secondary villains. Yeah. So is this going to be about World War One or the conquistadors? They don't draw, even though they're kind of working for the same goal, they don't draw any kind of like thematic parallel between the two of them.
Like, I would not be surprised if the magic conquistadors were Studio Note. They had nothing magical in the movie except maybe the tree at the end. Yeah. And then they were just like, we need monsters.
Yeah, we need cut the werewolves out of the Lone Ranger and we regret it. So this is like the version of the Lone Ranger that worked. Yeah. This is a heck of a lot better than the Lone Ranger, but you know, getting hit by a 2x4 is better than the Lone Ranger.
Ouch. Jesus.
Sorry,
it's not a good film.
Stoop to extremes occasionally.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's an easy watch. But yeah, it does feel like a studio monster, and it's difficult to see past this as sort of a cleansing exercise for the company, rather than them trying to make sort of a good adventure movie.
This feels like Disney trying to save face and trying to make a quick inoffensive buck. Which honestly, Disney has done way worse things. But I was just kind of singularly unimpressed by it. And so ultimately, I find it so forgettable, it's not really worth recommending. Like, I might give it a C, but I haven't decided yet.
I'm still sitting on
it's
that
like, this
as
is
well.
Hovering around C- territory. Not because it's awful, but because it's just so generic. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. We'll decide how kind I feel at the end of the podcast. Let's move on, and let's talk about a couple other big movies that I didn't get to see, unfortunately. I will catch up to these. But let's talk about, speaking of Disney films, David Lowery had previously directed the very good remake of Pete's Dragon, which had very little to do with the original. It just turned into its own thing.
I like everything about Pete's Dragon where the dragon's not involved. Mm. Like, I think the human story in that is really well done.
There's a lot of good stuff
in the movie. Sort of like a wild child character who moves in and like starts to rediscover humanity, but also has an invisible dragon.
Yeah.
And then it becomes like this big chase with the dragon, and the dragon's strapped to a truck and stuff. And that stuff's not interesting to me.
I kind of wish they'd kept the dragon in the realm of plausible deniability, where maybe there's a dragon and maybe there isn't. Like, that would have been kind of a stronger way to handle it. But even so, I think that movie is very well made, and I think David Lowery's a very talented filmmaker.
Yeah, I was very fond of his The Old Man and the Gun.
I missed that one.
Which was about an aging bank thief played by Robert Redford. It was supposed to be Robert Redford's like final leading role. I think it is his final leading role.
It's his final leading role. He'd had one more cameo in Avengers Endgame, which honestly, if you're gonna make one more like studio movie, you might as well make literally the biggest movie of all time.
Exactly. Like, and Robert Redford's in the biggest movie of all time.
It's hard to be mad at him for it. So, like, go for it.
David Lowery also did one of my favorite films of 2018, or it was 2017, A Ghost Story.
Yeah.
Which was this exploration of a ghost. And it just sort of told an idea of a haunting, what a ghost is haunting for, and what it happens when the ghost just sort of stays in one spot kind of indefinitely, and how time loses meaning. And, the ghost looks like a costume. It's like a guy
ghost in a white sheet. It looks like Charlie Brown Halloween.
On a sheet with white eye holes, but it's like really kind of ethereal and contemplative. Yeah. You made a point about A Ghost Story when we reviewed it back then, that it felt a little too like college student-y, because there's a scene in that movie where the ghost is haunting his widow. A guy dies and he's haunting his widow, and then the widow moves out. Like, the ghost loses track of time. And we don't
the
know
ghost is
time
trapped
is,
in this geographic location.
Exactly.
And so
new families move in. It's able to haunt a little bit, but a new family moves out. And then there's this scene where some college kids move into the house, and they start talking about death in one scene. They're having a party, and the ghost is there listening. And the film is essentially just sort of speaking its thesis aloud in that scene, but in a really inarticulate sort of way.
I find the thesis to be very much like, I took one philosophy class in college and now I feel smart.
I feel like there was sort of a function to that, but now that's a little bit sour, and I think I agree with you, because now I've seen The Green Knight.
Ooh.
And I feel like The Green Knight is about a guy who, like, read Chaucer for the first time, is like, yeah, I'm gonna do a movie of that. And I'm not gonna study much, but I found some really deep things. Now, it's not based on Chaucer the Green Knight. It's actually based on a medieval anonymous poem called Sir Gawain of the Green Knight, which I've read.
I read that in high school. Yeah. I read, actually, I think I read it before high school, because I was actually fond. There were two movies based on this.
Yeah, and I haven't seen the movies, but I've read the J.R.R. Tolkien translation from the Middle English.
Yeah.
Anyway, tell them about the films.
Oh yeah, real fast. I want to make sure they get the names right, because one of them is kind of weirdly named. One of them is called Sword of the Valiant, and it stars Miles O'Keefe. How much Keefe is in this movie?
Miles of it.
Yep. And the other one is hold on, I can't seem to. IMDb, you failed me again.
Well, I know Sean Connery plays the Green Knight in another version. I think it's called Gawain and the Green Knight.
There's Sean Connery is in... Okay, Gawain and the Green Knight was 1973.
Okay.
That one actually starred Nigel Green as the Green Knight. Sort of the Valiant is the one that stars Sean Connery.
Okay.
These movies were both directed and adapted, or co-adapted in one case, by a director named Stephen Weeks. He did two Green Knight movies within about a decade of each other. Weird. I saw them both when I was young. I found them a little interchangeable, but I have not revisited them much since. I think I saw Sword of the Valiant again like 15 years ago.
And here's a weird coincidence. Stephen Weeks also directed a film called Ghost Story.
Fuck you.
It's really, just by complete coincidence. Stephen Weeks did Gawain and the Green Knight in 1973 and a film called Ghost Story in 1974.
Okay, I'm looking forward to David Lowery's The Bengal Lancers. Monster.
He'll do it too.
And Scars. Those are the only other like feature films. Well, I guess Scars is a TV documentary, but whatever.
But yeah, David Lowery has now taken a crack at this anonymous poem and has made Dev Patel plays Sir Gawain, and it takes place at the end of King Arthur's life. It's a Christmas party in the movie. In the poem, it's a New Year's party.
Close enough.
And they. And while they're sort of sitting around, and a very aged, kind of sickly King Arthur, who has no nobility at all to him, sort of like this shrinking character, is saying, you're one of my most valiant knights, and maybe you'll be like my successor. What do you think of that, Sir Gawain? And Dev Patel's like, yeah, I can like maybe move my girlfriend in. She's a sex worker down the street. She's played by Alicia Vikander. Isn't that great? And just then... the Green Knight breaks in, and the Green Knight is essentially an ent from Lord of the Rings.
So he's an actual vegetation.
In this version thing, he's like has bark.
Swamp thing.
He looks like he's wearing a rubber mask. The knight looks terrible.
Oh, no.
But yeah, it's this guy in this rubber mask, he's this gigantic, massive thing, and he says, hey, you're noble knights, game. If you strike me, you can strike me as hard as you want. You can even, cut off my head. But in 1 year's time, you have to come to my church way out in the woods, and I will repay whatever strike you give me. And Sir Gawain says, well, I'm kind of a cocky blowhard. Cuts his head off.
Yeah.
And then the knight picks his head up, still alive, and puts his head back on and says, see you in a year. And Sir Gawain's like, oh, shit. And fast forward a year, Sir Gawain gets on his horse and says, well, I have to repay my debt, and treks out into the woods where he has a series of misadventures. At first, he finds a scavenger played by Barry Keoghan.
Oh, okay. I love Barry Keoghan.
Really, and he has a really good choice in films. He chooses really interesting projects.
Yeah. He's amazing in Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah.
Like, should have been Oscar nominated for that. He's fantastic in that film.
I think that film was a little too odd for a lot of audiences because
it's a horror movie.
It's a horror movie, and there's
like dressed up like an Oscar movie, but it's a horror movie.
It's a horror movie. It's got like a curse, but it never uses the word curse. So
fucking creepy.
It's like the characters start getting like this disease and the sickness, but it deliberately has never explained what the disease is or how they got it or how it spread.
It's so fucking scary. That movie actually scares the crap out of me.
It's just about Barry Keoghan just shows up and says, your family's going to get sick. And it happens.
Yeah. Really creepy.
Yeah, and he ends up getting mugged. Barry Keoghan and some compatriots take his stuff because they're scavengers. And there's this moment in the movie where Dev Patel is like tied up on the ground, and he's giving this kind of enigmatic performance where he's really kind of afraid of the world around him. You can tell he's not portraying like a noble cliche. He's playing sort of this kind of pathetic character. They're trying to subvert a lot of the nobility.
His ego came from a very fragile place.
He's driven by very base desires. There's nothing noble about this knight character. And when he's all trussed up, there's this 360 and of the woods. We just sort of very slowly look around the woods and we pan back to him and he's dead. He's a skeleton. And then we pan around again and he's okay again. And so
what a twist.
Yeah, it's this David Lowery is trying to sort of add a lot of these stylistic flourishes that are meant to get us to think very deeply about the death of the knight and how nobility is sort of this facade and there aren't really these noble characters in this world, but it's not about the world decaying. It's actually this really simple rendition of trying to take down ideas of knight errantry.
Right.
And I don't think there's much to this film beyond that. They're clearly going for a lot of like ghost stories. They're evoking a lot of criticisms that have been made about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight over the years. There's also an episode where he stops at a house that's being haunted, and this woman says, "My head was cut off. You need to go out into the sump and find my skull and return it to me," even though she's still like completely intact, and it's at night, and it's really spooky. There's a portion I did really love where he's just sort of riding through a valley, and we see over the crest of a mountain a giant's hand sort of pushing down. It hasn't been established that there are giants in this universe yet, so it's this weird kind of nightmarish imagery, and he rides up to the crest, and we see these like 200-foot-tall giants just sort of strolling along, speaking in giant language, which is this weird kind of gibberish. That part's really kind of dreamy and cool, but for the most part, I think David Lowery is just sort of flexing his style. Like I said, it feels like he's read medieval poetry for the first time, and it only has taken really surface interpretations of this material.
I will see this because I'm interested. I think Dev Patel is one of the most... I think he's one of the most interesting leading men we have right now. I think David Lowery has a lot of... more potential than anything. I think he's made some good movies, but nothing that I think is truly epic yet. In its quality, but really good. What you're saying reminds me in a weird way of some of my critiques of Zack Snyder, which is that he's incredible with his imagery. He knows how to paint like, you know, an epic vista or a gigantic larger than life image. But he seems so interested in tearing things down, he forgets to build them up first and actually show that he believes in the material, which is why I think, you know, his director's cut of Justice League works really well, because it's actually kind of genuine for a lot of it. But like his Batman v Superman doesn't, because it's just trying to destroy something he never made.
Yeah.
You know, like, we have to like, you know, really think about what Superman is. We don't have Superman yet. You gave us his origin, and his origin was like really weird and bleak and depressing and like questioning of itself. We never had Superman to tear down.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work. And the same thing with Batman. Yeah, we had less than Batman. Like, so like, you have to like, if you're going to break something, you have to prove you can do it, you know?
I feel like David Lowery he's using this ancient poem, which is very evocative, and he's putting in a lot of evocative imagery.
Yeah, and it's great, and it's short, too. There's no excuse not to read it. Like, it's really good.
Yeah, go out and grab it. You can find a $5 paperback of Tolkien's translation in any bookstop.
Yeah.
In any bookshop. There are bookshops still in my brain.
No, there are.
They're around.
Yeah. Not many, but thank God there are still some.
There's
around.
still some bookstores.
Yeah,
I feel like he's using the poem as a jumping off point to explore his own film passions, rather than really delve into the material. And I feel like David Lowery, while possessed of a style, you can recognize a David Lowery film, isn't a strong enough a stylist to justify that treatment of the material.
He's not like Tim Burton, where like, oh, Tim Burton's doing this story. Or, like, oh, I want to see what Tim Burton would do with that.
You know? Exactly. Like, Tim Burton a lot of Tim Burton's stories are incredibly shallow, or, you know, he deals with scripts sometimes that really aren't very good. But we go in because we like the visuals that Tim Burton is able to deliver, and the weird music and performances and the casting that he puts together. I feel like David Lowery he hasn't reached that high yet. Like, this is his strongest swing, but it feels like a lesser Wes Anderson type attempt, where he's setting things up in a really, really stylish way for the sake of the style. And the fact that he's drawing on an ancient poem, a medieval poem, is...
staying power beyond that which almost any filmmaker now could even claim.
It's inviting us to look into something deeper, but I don't think he did that. And this film is one of the best reviewed of the year, I think. I've heard people gush about this. People who have, like, degrees in medieval literature are really losing their minds over The Green Knight. I've merely read it. I don't have a degree in medieval literature. I've read Le Morte d'Arthur and some other Arthurian stories, but I'm no expert.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's my own ignorance. Maybe there is something going on here far more complex that if I were to study a lot more, I would be latching onto. But I feel like there's a surface artificiality to something like The Green Knight. You would think that this weird psychedelic art house A24 released film about a medieval poem would be right up my alley.
It sounds like it was delivered directly to your address.
This is kind of my jam, and I'm really upset that they kind of whiffed it. It can be on my level and still not appeal to me.
Just because something is made for you doesn't mean it was made well. It would be like if someone's like, hey, I made you some cupcakes. And like, you're like, oh, that's nice, but there's no sugar in these. So they don't taste good. That's fine. I appreciate the gesture. You made them for me. It didn't come out right.
I've brought up this before. I'm into like sort of weird, quirky music. And I was shopping at a record store, and I found one of those sort of second wave swing bands. They did like, in the vein of the Squirrel Nut Zippers. They did this extended klezmer song, like this this polka that told the life story of Tracy Lords, and I thought,
wow,
and it's like, okay,
that's a hell of a song,
an epic klezmer polka about the life of Tracy Lords. That's for me. That's something I would dig.
That's a very distinct.
So I snatched it off the shelf. I took it to a listening station, and you know what? They did it. They did a bad one. Aww. It's not a very good song. Good idea. Good form. Good topic. You did everything right, but you didn't pull it off. And I feel the same way about The Green Knight. Great idea, good topic, good starting off point. Dev Patel, great casting. He's very good. I like Alicia Vikander.
Yeah,
but you didn't land it. You didn't pull it off.
I'm gonna make everyone a deal right now. If you can find, and it has to be dated like before this episode comes out, you can find any review of The Green Knight that compares it to klezmer music other than this one, I will give you a huge shout out on a future episode of the show. But it has to be post-dated before this. You can't, and this one does not count. It can't be before this. As someone else compared this to klezmer. Seriously, I owe you a Coke.
So ultimately, The Green Knight was, and I don't like to use this word because this implies that I had a lot of expectations, but it was disappointing.
Sure.
It comes out swinging very hard and has all of this wonderful style in it, but
it's
not getting at anything deep enough to make it interesting. I recognize a lot of what it did do. Mm-hmm. It is deconstructing heroism. It is deconstructing his relationship with his mother, who might have summoned the Green Knight. There's this weird sort of psychedelic sequence at the beginning. I appreciate that the Green Knight is sort of a dour figure, a force of nature, and it is about man's arrogance versus the forces of nature. I see all of that. I'm simply not impressed with the way they told me.
You know, you were like, you used the word disappointing and then you backed off a bit. And I think you and I both agree that, anticipation isn't a good thing for a critical mindset.
Yeah.
It's perfectly natural. Everyone looks forward to things. Everyone's like, ooh, there's a new film from a director I like. I hope it's good. But building it up too much in your head can lead to disappointment or worse, trying to convince yourself it's something that it's not. Sometimes it really is great, but sometimes it's like, oh, that wasn't great, but you try to convince yourself that it's great and you end up apologizing for it more than you have to. Or maybe it's bad and you can't take it and it hurts. So But I think there's a difference between that and acknowledging that when you're adapting a classic text, it comes with baggage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if David Lowery had done Hamlet and he had done a bad Hamlet, that would be extra disappointing because it's Hamlet. Because
the world is familiar with Hamlet.
Yeah, and the world is to one extent or another. No, not everyone's read it, but The Green Knight is an enduring text.
Yeah.
So, it's got some built-in stuff. So, anyway, sounds like a bummer. Tell me about Stillwater.
Stillwater is the latest film from Tom McCarthy. He mostly known as an actor, but he's also directed some notable films.
Including Spotlight, which won Best Picture.
He did Spotlight. He did The Visitor, which I'm very fond of.
He did
Station Agent, which I'm very fond of. I didn't see his film Win-Win. I didn't see the Adam Sandler film he did, The Cobbler.
The Cobbler is one of the weirdest fucking things. It's Adam's real fast. Mm-hmm. In addition to directing, I think it was the same year Spotlight came out, actually. The Cobbler stars Adam Sandler as a cobbler in like a small borough in New York that's in the process of being gentrified. And he finds out that if he uses the old fashioned cobbling machine in his basement to repair shoes, and then he puts on those shoes, he becomes the person who owns those shoes.
That's right. There's like some magical conceit.
And the first thing he does is he almost does something so completely shockingly unethical that you hate him forever. And then after that, it tries to turn into like some weird dark man riff, but it's also a comedy, but it's also shockingly violent, and you don't know what the fuck to do with this. And it ends in a bit that like tries to set up a superhero universe, and it's one of the weirdest Adam Sandler movies.
That sounds like excitingly misguided.
It kind of is, actually. Yeah,
you're actually kind of like selling me on.
So
on the
many
cobbler.
Adam Sandler movies are so cookie cutter. You know, they're just going by a formula, and I know the formula works. No one's pretending the formula doesn't work. People like the dang things. This one does stand out as being really weird. So if you want to see a weird Adam Sandler movie with some gross stuff in it, and some interesting ideas, I suppose, too. The Cobbler from the guy who did Spotlight. Between Win-Win, he did The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win-Win, the Adam Sandler superhero shoe movie, then Spotlight. Interesting choices. Anyway, moving on.
And I do love Spotlight. Tom McCarthy is also a Hollywood screenwriter for hire, and he's done like Disney movies. One of his films he wrote and directed was like Timmy Failure, which was a kid's film.
Yeah, he co-wrote the screenplay for Christopher Robin, which is so generic.
He did some punch up on a film I haven't seen called The Nutcracker in the Four Realms, which is one of Disney's bigger bombs.
It looks so weird. He did Million Dollar Arm, which is actually a pretty cute film.
Yeah,
and he worked on the screenplay for Up.
Million Dollar Arm is like the best movie Fred McMurray didn't have a chance to be in.
Kinda, yeah.
And now he's doing Stillwater, which is about a blue-collar working-class dude from the South, played by Matt Damon. Mm. Matt Damon's in the news right now because of some things he said.
Pretty bad. Not the worst thing ever, but pretty. Well, he's not going to jail or anything.
No,
but
he's
being shitty.
He just revealed that he's is now and has always been just sort of like a Boston meathead kind of guy.
It's bad. I don't want to underplay it, but to say he's not gonna go to jail.
Good screenwriter and good actor besides, but also said some pretty bad things. He plays a fellow who he's working out just sort of getting jobs as he can. He's a lot of construction jobs. He does clean up when the houses are demolished. And at the beginning of the movie, he goes off to Marseille in France, where his daughter, played by Abigail Breslin, has been in prison for the last number of years. She was imprisoned for murdering her roommate. This was a story, and she has been passing notes to him to take to local investigators to reopen her case. She heard something in prison and feels like she can be exonerated. She claims she didn't do it. And Matt Damon reads the note, like has somebody translate the note because it's written in French. And she essentially says in the note, do this yourself. Don't trust my dad just because he's a massive fuck up. He can never do anything right. And we actually get to see this really interesting depiction of the Matt Damon character, because it's about a guy who actually really can't do anything really right trying to make good. And yeah, like, he doesn't really have the mental wherewithal to take care of something like this, but he actually begins to try and he begins to investigate. He ends up falling in with a local played by an actress named Deanna Dunigan.
Okay.
Or no, Deanna Dunigan plays the grandmother, excuse me.
For Camille... Is it Camille Cotton plays Virginie?
Camille Cotton. He ends up falling in with her. He just sort of runs into her and ends up spending more and more time with her. And they end up sort of living together and then bonding and then falling in love. It's actually this sort of long form story about how he's trying to help his daughter and ends up falling in love with a local. And things continue apace. And eventually he... makes a really, really, really bad decision two-thirds of the way through the movie, which end up kind of lousing everything up for everybody. It's a really interestingly told character drama, and I think Matt Damon gives a really great performance as this kind of meathead guy, this American guy named Bill, who is trying to figure out Europe. It's a culture clash movie. What does this... average American man do when he's living in Marseille, and what sort of things is he going to pick up on? How do the French think of this guy? And in fact, he's asked point blank at one point, did you vote for Trump? And he says, no, I didn't. You didn't? No, I'm a con. I was not allowed to vote. So it kind of skirts around the fact that this guy would have if he had the chance. So it's, you know, what happens when a Trump voter has to live abroad for a long time? And I feel like the film very sensitively handles a lot of that stuff. Tom McCarthy is interested in those kinds of relationships. If you've seen The Station Agent or The Visitor, those are movies about characters learning to sort of appreciate one another. And I think he's very sensitive to that effect. I do, however, have to mention that this is inspired by a true story.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to get to that, because this has become a big narrative for the film. Again, I didn't see this one.
Yeah.
But this film was directly inspired, but they've talked about it in interviews, by Amanda Knox, who was an American...
I actually didn't know the Amanda Knox story, but she's an American.
Oh, wow.
She was living in Italy, and she too was accused of murdering her roommate and had to go through a lot of horrendous legal problems
She was convicted she was convicted of the murder and then later on and years later, she was eventually exonerated. She was completely railroaded. She was turned into this enormous tabloid centerpiece where people were, like, assuming that she was at the center of some wild sex scandal murder plot. And actually it was some other guy, and they had, like, his bloody fingerprints, and he'd already been in jail at the time for doing something else, and they just never pursued it because...
There's so many stories
true about police who are just like, they can't admit the wrong.
Yeah.
So they have to pursue everything as far as it can possibly go. Amanda Knox's life was effectively destroyed. And she's trying to put her life together. And now here comes Tom McCarthy making a movie that sensationalizes her life, makes it about a man. Yeah, and I don't know how it handles, like, the character. Abigail Breslin's obviously based on Amanda Knox. This is not Amanda Knox. She's not named Amanda Knox, but it is giving the impression to people who probably, there are a lot of people like you, probably vaguely remember the story or don't know it very well at all. And now this is going to tint how they look at it.
Yeah, I didn't know the Amanda Knox story. And yeah, this is, it's one of those things where, like, it's not legally actionable. Like, it's different enough from her story that they can just tell the story.
But it's like primary colors. We know.
Well, I was going to say it's like an episode of Law and Order where it's like very evocative of a real life crime, but it's not that crime. And as such, in terms of, like, the real story, it actually really does Amanda Knox a horrendous disservice because of what, and I can't say what happens because this reveals the ending of the movie, but the way they treat the Amanda Knox character by the end of the film is kind of rewriting history in a way that's really unfair to Amanda Knox. As a character piece, it's incredibly well done and it's incredibly well acted, but it's now tainted by the way it didn't really consider how it was treating a real person. I think it was treating it, I think it was treating Amanda Knox like something intellectual, like a media thing that happened, rather than a human being that they could have reached out to.
And it's not like some historical figure where, like, there's you creative license isn't going to hurt their lives or anything.
Yeah, it would be like if you made a movie about two Olympic skaters and one murdered the other, and you never talked to Tonya Harding about any of that.
Yeah, or Nancy Kerrigan,
Nancy Kerrigan, or anybody who was actually involved.
Yeah, and everyone would know what you were getting at, and everyone would.
Unfortunately kind of weighted the film against itself, even though it's a really thoughtful, well-paced, well-acted story about American culture and French culture sort of blending together a little bit.
Yeah.
That the Amanda Knox character is kind of written out of it for a lot of the story. And now that I'm now calling her the Amanda Knox character, is kind of an issue now.
This is
all something that came up after the fact, because I didn't know the Amanda Knox story. I'm just ignorant that way.
Well, you know, but you now, don't now know that, everything that's ever happened, and you don't really follow that kind of news. But I feel like I just want to clarify, I haven't seen this movie. I am discussing the criticism that I've heard, some of it from Amanda Knox herself, who again was not just, like, let go. She was completely exonerated legally. Like, they just flat out said, you did not do this.
She was convicted in 2007 and wasn't exonerated until 2015.
Yeah, like, a huge chunk of her life has been taken up by this, and here it's coming up again, and that sucks. But I feel like what is necessary is, regardless of whether or not the movie works on its own merits, which I cannot speak, it does speak to a conversation we need to have. And I know some people, like, are eager to leave this out of film criticism, but I think it's part of it is the importance of ethical filmmaking, which is filmmaking does not exist in a vacuum. Filmmaking connects with people. Filmmaking affects people's perception of things. And while you can't always control that, there are definitely ways that you can maximize the positive impact you're making a movie, even if it is about something dark or unpleasant or ugly. And it sounds like somewhere down the line here, people kind of got
kind
of got wrapped up in themselves. I don't know. I can't say this. I wasn't there. That's the concern right now.
It's a case of they clearly were intellectualizing Amanda Knox, and they just weren't sensitive. They weren't thinking about her.
They weren't thinking about her as a person.
Yeah, it wasn't that they thought of her and wanted to, like, do her a disservice and tell her story differently. Mm-hmm. It was just that they weren't thinking about it. They just heard about her,
and it was like, how can we make this about her dad?
More or less. Let's make a story about what would the dad go through? What would a dad go through if you were in a similar situation?
And interesting choices.
And it is a little too close to the actual Amanda Knox story that, Amanda Knox spoke up about it.
Yeah. Well, and as is her right. Again, I haven't seen this one. I will let you know if I think it is good in spite of all that, or even if I have some other weird take that has nothing to do with anything we discussed. But I haven't had a chance to yet. It's been a rough week or two. So I also didn't see A Mofe. Which is also called, or in the parenthetical, This Is My Desire.
Yeah, A Mofe, This Is My Desire, as it's released here in the United States. This is a Nigerian film by, I apologize for my pronunciation, Airi Esiri and Chuko Esiri. Mm-hmm. They're just credited as Airi and Chuko. They're brothers. And this is sort of a diptych. It's two stories. The first half of this film involves a fellow named Mofe. It's played by Jude Akawudike. And he is...
We're trying our best in the pronunciation. Yeah, we're sure we're doing it probably wrong, but we're trying. Yeah.
And he is an electrician in some like kind of run down buildings in Lagos. And he dreams of leaving Lagos. In fact, This Is My Desire relates to the desire to leave. They want the characters in this movie want to get out of their poverty and their bad situation. This character Mofe lives with his sister and her child, and he works all of these electric boxes. And there's a lot of really meaningful, penetrating shots of these tangled wires in these electrical boxes, and they use little pieces of cardboard barely, like, just stuck between the wires to make sure they don't touch and short everything out. And that's a symbol that's gone back to again and again. it was shot really beautifully on 16mm film, and the filmmakers have a really excellent knack of sort of saturating everything so it looks really cinematic, but also infusing it with this very palpable kitchen sink realism. So you're really kind of there in the moment, but it still feels very movie. I haven't seen anything that balances it quite this way yet. Mm. All of a sudden, off camera, and you're not even sure it happened at first, the sister and the daughter die.
Oh.
They're just out of the movie. And this leads the Mofei character into this weird bureaucratic nightmare as to how to secure all of these papers, some of which might not be real, some of which definitely are faked, in order to move to the United States and open up a business there. And how this bureaucratic nightmare essentially just strips him of all of his humanity to the point where he just loses all hope. Then we stop his story and we move over to a character named Rosa, played by Temi Emmy Williams. And it's about her story and about how she and her, I think it's her, a relative of hers, it's her niece or her daughter, are also trying to leave. And she is a bartender, and a lot of her story involves how she needs to essentially flirt with a white American who's visiting Lagos. Mm. To essentially curry favor so that she can also leave the country. And there's also a plot we eventually learn for, like, her relative is pregnant and they are planning on selling the baby so they can leave the country as well.
Wow.
So that's, there's a couple scenes where the two characters sort of interact. And Mofei will be back by the end of the movie.
Mofei will be back in The Spy Who Loved
Me. In Avengers Endgame. Yeah. This is a very human, very humane, but also incredibly harrowing story. It's very, very sad, and it is very careful about presenting desperation and poverty without it seeming at all exploitative. These characters are actually very human, but they're at the end of their rope, so they're at sort of a constant fever pitch of emotion, but it never feels like it leaves the real world. It's never so stylized as that. It's really, really well done.
Wow.
Realism is a pretty hard thing to pull off. It's becoming a lot more easy for a lot of filmmakers because a lot of filmmakers just have smaller digital cameras. They're a lot more affordable now, mm-hmm. and they can just sort of take them down. These filmmakers are Airi and Chuko. They clearly have a lot of talent. They understand the craft, and because they're shooting on film, understand how to sort of like set up and lock down and frame up shots in ways that make it seem like it's sort of like a throwback to something like Killer of Sheep, where we're just sort of living with these people. We're sort of down on ground level. There's a lot of like Ozu type shots where the camera's a little bit lower. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of looking at a room for a really long time.
Yeah, it's not about just moving the plot forward. It's about feeling like you live there.
Like we're in a lot of these spaces, and what they're capturing with all of these lockdown shots are how cramped everything is. Everything takes place in these little tiny square rooms, and everybody's standing really close together, and it makes you feel sweaty, like when you're standing so close to all of these people. I think these are filmmakers that maybe we should keep an eye out for. Mm-hmm. I've seen several Nigerian films recently. Of all the films I've seen from Africa, I think I've seen the most from Nigeria, and I think we might be on this weird cusp of maybe a Nigerian new wave. This is what this feels like to me. That's something like a movement is about to start.
Maybe it already has.
You know, we're in the United States, so maybe there's a lot more like this in Nigeria. But I'm really excited to have seen this because I feel like it's something's going to come up.
That's amazing. Mm. I saw a Netflix rom-com.
Oh my God.
Well, I have to review it. Mm. Give me that.
Tell me about the Netflix rom-com. Falling in Love or whatever it's called.
You're thinking of Falling in Love.
Yes.
Which starred Christina Milian. This is Resort to Love, which stars Christina Milian. Hmm. Yeah. No, this is, it's not from the same filmmaker, although it has a similar vibe. Falling in Love was about a woman who ended up acquiring like an inn in this like gorgeous, you know, faraway place, and then like she's cleaning it up and she ends up falling in love with someone, and it's very cute. Not a lot to it. Pretty generic. It's very cute. Sometimes inoffensive is why we're here. We're not here to like anything. Yeah, we're not. There's no like, oh, wow us with like this incredible experience. Let's go on a ride. And then the ride is not exciting. It's just sort of, okay, that's a bummer. When you're looking at a low-budget, like, straight-to-Netflix romantic comedy, the bar's set a little lower. Let's just be fair. The bar is a little, you know, we're not expecting Sleepless in Seattle here. We're expecting something cute. And sure enough, that is actually what we get. I'm going to be perfectly frank. This movie is cute. Christina Milian plays a young woman who, not that long ago, her engagement collapsed. She was focused on her music career. Her fiancé left her to get another job somewhere else. And she's still working through all of that baggage. But at least her singing career is picking up. And she's a featured singer on a new album from this sort of fictional Kanye West type character. It's supposed to be this like musical legend, sells millions upon millions of records. Is, you know, considered an eccentric. And she's going to, at the beginning of the movie, a listening party for their new album. And it's very, very exciting. It's all very hush-hush. You know, a surprise new album, everything. And she gets there, and she's super excited. This is it. This is her big moment. And then the dude says, "All right. I told you last time that anytime, if ever anyone leaked any of my music again before I wanted it to come out, there would be no more music. So this album will never come out." And he, like, smashes his laptop in front of everybody. And it's actually, like, and that gets us started off on, a funny note. It's a funny, like, we expected, like, her career's not going to go great because otherwise there's no movie. You know, she's got to, like, get set back and move up. It's like, we got to have that. But I appreciate that this is actually going for kind of big emotions and, like, scenes that actually make an impression as opposed to just, we're just going to lightly glide you through this rom-com. There's going to actually be some unexpected bits. And sure enough, she ends up absolutely miserable. And after a few months of grieving her career and grieving the loss of her relationship, she agrees to take a gig, a temporary gig, working on the island of Mauritius, which is in Africa. And we're off the coast of Africa, rather. She's going to work at a resort singing. She's going to work at a nice, fancy resort singing to tourists. And she says to herself, that could actually be kind of nice. You know, just get stay busy. And then she gets there and she finds out that half of the gig is singing at weddings. And the first one is she's supposed to sing the theme from Dirty Dancing. And she breaks down in tears and sings it like all weeping and sad. And it's,
but I've had the time of my life.
Yeah, it's actually pretty funny.
Okay.
I actually like, that's actually kind of funny. It's a wedding singer vibe. Wedding Singer was over 20 years ago now. I don't think it's sacrosanct to do a Wedding Singer bit. This is cute. The movie starts getting like really contrived, like super duper mega contrived, when it turns out that one of the weddings she's supposed to be singing at is the wedding of her ex-fiance, who is here with his fiance. The script bends over backwards to make that seem plausible. Like, they try to explain it, like, oh yeah, we're on social media, and we're friends with the same social media person, and boy, does she know algorithms, and I'm like, of all the fucking places on the planet for New Yorkers to go. What really, really makes this awkward is, they see her there. This is super awkward. What are you doing here? She explains that they're working there, and he decides to tell his fiance, his new fiance, that I used to know this lady. We used to be friends. He doesn't mention that they used to be dating or engaged. And as a result, his fiance thinks this is just one of my soon-to-be husband's old friends. I need to involve them in all of the wedding stuff. And it gets really awkward. And will they or won't they get back together? And wouldn't you know it? Her ex-fiance, played by Jay Farrow, has an older brother who is a super-duper mega-stud, awesome hunk of a man, played by Cinco Walls. Will they get together? I don't know. Maybe you can guess.
When I see these movies, I always want them to go like full bore queer. Like she runs off with the bride.
Please.
That's what I want to see.
Because this is actually something I like about the movie. And there's actually quite a bit I like about this movie. It's aiming low, but it's hitting hard. There are no villains in it. It'd be so easy. Mm. So easy. To make his new fiance a horrible person who's like going after him for money or something like that, just to make a conclusion foregone, you know, just to make it seem like everyone's going to be happy at the end. Someone, you know, it's fine. No, she's lovely. She's a really nice person. They're fast friends. She's really cool. She's actually like interested in like. She wants to run for Congress. She really cares about their community that she lives in, and okay. she's just super duper awesome, and that just makes this more awkward. Mm. And that's fun. That's funny. It's good that these things are big. Like she even like they do karaoke for the bachelorette party, and it turns out that the new fiance is as good a singer. She just belts some Nicki Minaj, and she's amazing. And it's like, oh my god, and I still like them because they're cool, even though they're engaged to the person I was engaged to. That level of goodwill is infectious. And that's why we go to this kind of like pleasing lo-fi rom-com. We just want to be charmed a little. And they do that. There's a really clever bit of low-budget filmmaking you can learn from this movie where there's a guy when Christina Milian goes to Mauritius. She's picked up at the airport by a guy named Barrington, she says, "Oh, so you're like the chauffeur for the hotel?" It's like, "Yeah, I'm also the groundskeeper, and I'm also in your band, and I'm also like, oh, he's doing all these jobs." And there's a justification in the plot, which is like, he moved here and he fell in love with someone here and he needs money so that they can buy a house. So he's taking all these extra jobs. But what it actually means is you only need to hire one guy to play all of these incidental roles at the hotel. So like if you're going past the scene and there needs to be a pool boy, it's just that guy again. And he gets to be in the movie a lot have a couple of scene stealing moments.
It's a cute cost saving.
It's maneuver, a really cute cost saving measure. Like I'm just watching this and I'm just like, you know, I could teach this in a class and be like, hey, what can we learn from this bit of casting? Because it elevates the character and makes a bunch of really minor characters who would have no impression whatsoever actually a memorable part of the movie, and behind the scenes, a very practical choice. This is a very nuts and bolts kind of rom-com, but it's reasonably well made. The island of Mauritius is fucking gorgeous. Like, they went there. Good. It's a travelogue, obviously.
They shoot movies, you know, at beautiful resort locations, partly so the cast and the crew can go on a vacation.
Oh yeah, no. Look at the entire career of John Stockwell behind the camera. John Stockwell, who a lot of people know was like the best friend jock character from like the movie Christine, and he did some other movies as well. But then he started moving behind the camera, and almost every single movie he's ever directed is at a tropical beach.
He did
like Into the Blue, and I think he did. Didn't he do Turistas? Was that him as well? And it was some Halle Berry one as well. Just makes movies about being at a tropical beach.
You'll notice how a lot of Adam Sandler films also take place at like resorts. Jack and Jill, I know, is a big part. Like a cruise is a big part of that movie.
Blended, they go to South African resort.
We mentioned it already. Just Go With It as another resort movie. He likes to fold his vacations into his work.
I mean, if you can do it, I don't blame you. It's not necessarily like I'm not exactly impressed per se, but you know what? Good gig if you can get it. Oh, I can't complain.
Oh, no, William and I have to go to a film festival and Mauritius. And
yeah, like,
I think that's why in the massage parlor.
Sometimes I think that's why there's a film festival in, like, Sundance in, like, January. Because, like, yeah, it's starting to warm up a little, but it's also, like, a whole bunch of people who aren't used to living at that altitude, having, like, potential altitude sickness, and also it could potentially get really super fucking cold, and, like, you're driving to places in a blizzard, and there's no visibility, and it makes you work for it. It doesn't feel like a vacation. It doesn't anyway. You're working your ass off at all those festivals if you're doing it right. Like, you're constantly going to different screenings. But anyway, so no, this is a vacation movie. This is a movie that is designed to go down smooth. And it does. The cast is cute. It does what you want it to do. I actually enjoy it. And I'm going to recommend it. So on the critically acclaimed scale, we review movies on the critically acclaimed scale. That is from C- to C+. Where C- is the lowest a movie can get. C+ is the highest a movie can get. Below average or above average, and most movies are C is just average. I'm tempted to give Resort to Love a C+ for doing what it set out to do really well. I think, on the other hand, though, that without listening to this review, if you had heard that we'd given it our highest rating, it would feel a bit hyperbolic. I feel like in a vacuum it doesn't look good. So I'm gonna say this: it's a very high C. Okay. I appreciate a movie that does what it sets out to do, even if those goals are modest. And you can't take it away from it. It's never quite so amazing that it's like, you have to see this. This is incredible. But it's well done for what it is. And the movie deserves credit for that. The people who made it deserve credit for that. It's cute. If you're looking for cute, Resort to Love does that job. So I have a suspicion that you're going to say A Mofe is a C+.
It is a C+. Okay. This is making sort of the art house circuit in the big cities, but I imagine you'll be able to find it on streaming soon enough. Okay. And I recommend it. I think you should seek this one out. I think it's, like I said, I may be completely wrong about this, but this feels like something really exciting is about to start happening. So.
Nice. That's wonderful. Stillwater.
It is a C, but as it's a qualified C because it's tainted by sort of its irresponsible politic. And it's a pity because it actually is a very sensitive piece of work, but it's not so sensitive that it took real life into consideration.
It's how sensitive can it possibly be? Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. The Green Knight.
The Green Knight. Oh, heaven help me. That is a C-. I think it's... It mistakes its style for ideas and storytelling acumen, and it actually doesn't. I feel like it doesn't have those things.
That's a shame.
Yeah,
yeah.
I would like you to see it though, because I know I'm my opinion is in the vast minority on this one.
I love Arthurian lore. I love Arthurian film. I've seen most of the big Arthurian movies. I never saw the Antoine Fuqua film, King Arthur. I always meant to get around to that with Clive Owen and Keira Knightley. Yeah. I know, but I want to be a completionist about it. This is, for whatever reason, that's a really big one. I never got around to it.
The Guy Ritchie was bad.
The Guy Ritchie one was bad, actually.
The Fuqua was bad. It's okay.
But there's a lot of really, really great Arthurian movies in there. Some of them are merely interesting. Some of them are truly epic. If you're looking, for me, Excalibur and Monty Python are the gold standard. They're very different films, but they do it really well.
I think Monty Python kind of ruined a lot of Arthurian films for me.
Kind of undermined them forever.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I can't watch anything with Lancelot without thinking of him saying, "Blue, thank you," and then getting arrested by the cops.
Lancelot du Lac. See Lancelot du Lac.
Lancelot du Lac.
Lancelot du Lac. I want to make sure I'm not crazy here. Yeah, it's a Robert Bresson film.
Robert Bresson film.
And it's a very pulled back, very humanistic tale of Lancelot without any of the fanciful trappings. And I think if you feel a little, you know, tainted by Monty Python's, you know, comedic
silliness,
and you can't take it seriously anymore, that's a really, really good place to sort of reset your brain.
Okay, well,
it's a really good film.
I dig Bresson.
A lot of people don't even realize he did a King Arthur movie. Like, he did, and it's a good one. And then lastly, our review of Jungle Cruise. Whitney, where do you land?
You know, it is a very unenthusiastic low C. It's not a failure. It does everything it wants to do. It just didn't have very big ambitions.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to. There's... There's so much more that can be done with this, the adventure genre than just do another one.
And that's the thing, is I'm actually not entirely sure it does do what it sets out to do. Because it clearly is setting out to evoke other popular things. It's not the first movie to do that. No one can complain about that. Star Wars does that. Who gives a shit? For me, I feel like this movie is trying to be an exciting piece of escapist entertainment. It's trying to make us feel like we're on a ride. It's trying to make us feel like we're escaping to this wonderful land of adventure and gorgeous locales. And that's where I think it fails. I think it ends up feeling like a very rote, formulaic, drab ride. And that's not a good ride, is it? So it's not hard to watch. I can't in good conscience give it a C minus, but I'm with you. It's a very, very low C. Yeah. I just think, I think it flunks out on a different level than you do. But yeah, but again, the cast is very, very charming. It's certainly like airy and moves along reasonably well. The CGI cat is never convincing for a second, but I will cut you some slack because you put a cat in the movie.
Proxima is a leopard.
I was watching Resort to Love, and Luca, my cat Luca, our cat Luca rather. He's not in the movies. He doesn't like watch movies. He's a cat. He got into Resort to Love. Like, he got into it. Like, when, like, Christina Milian was, like, singing at the end, he was, like, you know, just sort of laying there, whatever, and he just popped up and, like, who is this? Who is this wonderful siren singing a wonderful duet or ode to my greatness? Like, he just totally fell in love with Resort to Love. So I guess that gives a little extra bonus points. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week with reviews of films like The Suicide Squad. Not just a Suicide Squad. The Suicide Squad.
We'll make another one called Suicide Squads.
Oh God, they probably will.
Yeah.
More than
one squad now.
And also the new, it's a Leos Carax film, right?
Yeah, Annette is the title.
So we got a couple of big ones coming to next week. I'm sure we'll find other things to review as well.
Yeah, Annette is actually a companion piece to the Sparks Brothers, because it's an opera written by Sparks.
Yeah, that's a hell of a thing.
And they're in it, and they've always wanted to make a movie. As they explained in the documentary, they tried to make one with Tim Burton. It fell through. They tried to make one with Jacques Tati. That one fell through.
Ooh, that's interesting.
But they finally landed Leos Carax. So at least they're pursuing interesting filmmakers.
They sure are. So we'll review that on the next episode of Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We think you're amazing. We just think you're neat. So if you want to join in the conversation, want to talk about anything we discussed on this episode, you're more than welcome to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. I was under the weather last week, and it messed with our production schedule, but We've Got Mail is coming back this week. So we might read your email in an upcoming episode of that. We also have a P.O. box if you want to send us some snail mail, or sometimes people want to send us just whatever, trinkets sometimes. Always appreciate it. Very kind. not a requirement, but people have asked. So, Whitney, what's your P.O. box?
It's P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. Make it out to me or to William or to the Critically Acclaimed Network. We'll get it.
If you like the show and you want to help out the show, there's a bunch of different ways to do it. There's the absolutely free of charge way, which is to leave us a review wherever you find us. A star rating, preferably a couple of sentences. It really helps people find the show and show that all of the people who distribute podcasts that this show is getting what we call in the business engagement. So, obviously be honest, but, you know, it really, really helps us out if you leave us a review. If you can afford to, we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive material over at that Patreon. We have podcasts dedicated to every single episode of Batman from the 1960s. We have a podcast dedicated to every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. It's called Only the Best. In the last couple of days, we released our episode about the first half of the 10 nominees of 1942, which is an interesting crop of films. Some films you've heard of, some films you probably haven't, because even we hadn't. And we also have commentary tracks and online hangouts and a whole bunch of other stuff besides. So that is all at our Patreon. And of course, we're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
If you like soap, head on over to the Salt Cat Soap Store over on Etsy. If you follow Salt Cat Soap on Twitter or Instagram, the link is right there. We just had a giveaway of some soaps and also one of M. Lopez de Silva's books. Yeah, we'll have more like cool events like that in the future. But in the meantime, soap is magical. Everyone likes soap. Makes you feel good and clean. So head on over to Etsy. We have a wonderful array of soaps. And this coming Saturday, first Saturday of the month, we always drop some new designs. So be sure to check that out. And I think that's it, right? Am I forgetting anything?
That's it. We'll be back next week.
We sure will be back next week. And until then, never forget, everyone's a critic.